Bible reading this week is in Matthew 6, if you want to grab your Bible and head over there. In the middle chapter of the Sermon on the Mount, which is where we are in our reading through the Gospel of Matthew. And so that brings us to, I don't know, arguably some of the more familiar segments of the sermon.
Maybe the one of the most familiar sections of the whole sermon.
Right, right. And so if we're just going to kind of break that down, he does some of this stuff at the beginning of 6 about practicing your righteousness before men. That's kind of a starting point,
right,
isn't it?
Well, yeah, and it kind of connects out of what he's been doing in chapter 5, right? I mean, he gives that strong statement back in chapter 5 that your righteousness must exceed the scribes,
right,
and the Pharisees,
mm-hmm,
you know, if you're going to be fit for God's kingdom. And then, of course, we're more familiar with him and what he immediately does with the whole, you know, it's not just what you do, it's what, how you think about it as well. You know, it's not just don't commit adultery, it's don't lust. It's not just, you know, don't kill, it's don't give in to hate and anger. And so by the same token, you get here now, he's still going back to areas in which righteousness can be compromised. These are, you know, ostensibly religious acts, though. This is not just kind of the moral life, but religious acts when he talks about, you know, almsgiving and praying and fasting.
Yeah, in fact, a great way to structure that segment is kind of with that phrase he works in 6:3, but when you give to the poor is the right way to do it.
Right.
And then again in verse 6, but you when you pray.
Yeah.
And then you get down to verse 17, but you when you fast. So we have giving and praying and fasting.
Well, and that phrase is like, it's this chapter's, this section's equivalent to what he was doing in chapter 5. You have heard it said, but I say unto
right.
you. Now he's doing that now with religious acts. You know, he's gone from moral hypocrisy to religious hypocrisy is what he's done. And so the same thing, yeah, you've got this kind of these stock phrases where he's comparing and contrasting or trying to put on your radar how you've done it, how you've seen it done by, you know, by your religious leaders and others versus what I'm telling you is the real way a kingdom citizen, you know, does these things.
And I guess to some degree we have a little bit of trouble relating to this because we don't, especially with regard to fasting and prayer, we don't associate those with being outward things where people would look at you. And it seems to me that's ultimately what he's reasoning here is your heart needs to be right in this and that you're not doing this as some sort of outward expression of piety to impress other people, but that your heart needs to be right, need to be doing it for the right reason.
Yeah.
And so it's that whole inward and outward thing, again, like he was playing off of it at the end of chapter 5. We don't typically, again, think about, for example, prayer being something that other people see most of the time. Maybe public prayers could fall
into services.
That trap. But for them, that would have been different.
Well, in some ways, this is the ancient version. I've got to be careful here, but this is kind of the ancient version of, you know, because human nature doesn't change. This is the ancient version of, you know, when people use social media to try to get the attention to themselves today, you know, and put things up that, you know, are attention getting and designed to be attention getting. This is the ancient version of that, where people were using these kinds of what should have been devotional practices as ways of showing off and showing how pious.
Virtue signaling.
Exactly. My ancient version of virtue signaling. That's exactly right.
Wow. It's interesting that you brought up the social media thing. Are you trying to bait me down down that path? Because I do think that is really something to ponder. You know, the danger of being in the business of advertising ourselves.
Yeah, building a platform, you know, having influence, being an influencer, all
these
phrases.
Others to be impressed with us in what we're doing religiously.
That's right.
Rather than being content that God be glorified and his work be done, which
that's
needs to be our motive all the time. Should we say a word about fasting? Sometimes that's a little bit of a hiccup point for people.
Yeah.
They fasted back then. We don't, I shouldn't say this. As a practice, I don't think fasting is as common today.
Well, if there any of these is private today, it'd be fasting.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Some of the health people are pretty public about that.
Well,
fasting.
Yeah, and of course that's for health, not religious reasons.
Yes.
You know, that's for the trying to preserve life as opposed to self-discipline of the body.
Yeah. So someone's going to inevitably ask, fasting is commanded, why don't we obey the commandment?
Right. Well, I mean, because it's personal, just like, you know, the Bible doesn't set when and how I pray. The Bible doesn't tell me how much to give. this is a, you know, again, what Jesus is doing is bringing this back to it's between you and God and your heart and God. And so, you know, the way I talk about today is, you know, fasting, you know, the whole point of fasting was really just doing without otherwise legitimate and good things, food, you know, we typically think of, but doing without otherwise legitimately good and even needful things for a season as a way of, again, exercising self-discipline and reminding us that, you know, man does not live by bread alone, but every word, but, you know, from the mouth of God, and focusing on spiritual things above physical, even legitimately needful physical things. And so the point is, it's not about, you know, how much or how little you do it. It's about using it for the purposes for which it exists. Which is about your developing spiritual self-discipline and keeping the things above as the focus, not the things below.
Yeah, and that's kind of where my mind was going, that part of the benefit of fasting, whatever it's from, is to exercise or to demonstrate that you exercise control over that dimension of your life rather than being subjected to it. I play some little games with myself regarding phones and devices. Because I get into to negative habits, for example, of, you know, waking up first thing in the morning, my devices are right next to me, so I grab a device, right. See what's happening with the weather today.
Sure.
See if I have any email.
Astros.
Only during the good season for sports. But but I will even discipline myself to say, you know, I don't need to look at the emails first thing in the morning.
That's right.
I could go eat breakfast. I can go drink coffee, which will put me in a better frame of mind to look at emails. Yep. Anyway.
Brace yourself, yeah.
So I think that that there is a need to show that these are things we've committed to our control rather than letting them control of it. You could make the same point about food or devices or whatever.
Though I think, you know, even, you know, the ancient world, I mean, especially they're thinking about, you know, fasting from food. Though obviously I agree with you. I think, you know, today it can be, you know, we can use it in a lot of ways. The point is self-discipline, self-control. But I think it's interesting, you know, in the world in which we have so many experts and authorities from the world talking about what we need and justifying making what might be decisions that are immoral or go against God's will, suffering for righteousness, say, going against God's will in the name of meeting your needs. Mm-hmm. You know, that part of what fasting reminds us is the only thing that's needful ultimately is God.
Right.
And that there simply is no even legitimate earthly life need that trumps spiritual orientation towards God. And so if I can, you know, learn to practice self-discipline, self-denial, self-control, you know, even over, you know, how I eat, which is an unarguably necessary thing for life, right, then there's simply no other justification for sin, for going against what God says in the name of needs. People need this. I need this. Some authority told me I should have this because it's a legitimate need when it causes me to transgress.
Yeah. First world problems.
First world problems.
Yeah. That's so it. This last segment, I really think that you could just group 19 to 34, and he has this extended conversation about stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the refreshing things about that is that there's nothing new about wrestling with stuff and keeping life balanced between earthly treasure and spiritual treasure.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think the whole, you know, that whole section flows naturally because when he starts with the whole, where's your treasure, you know, where your heart is, there will your treasure be also. And then it naturally flows into his section on anxiety and worry. You know, part of the issue is, you know, especially the form of anxiety and worry that he's talking about in this section, it's about loss. It's about doing without. You know, what happens if I don't have enough to eat, don't have, you know, what I need, going back to needs again as we perceive them. You know, and part of why we're so anxious about this is because ultimately it's a reflection of where our treasure is. If we're not even legitimate needs, you know, at the end of the day, we're all still going to die and this earth is still going to pass away. And the only thing that lasts is God and the treasure in heaven. And so ultimately, we begin to recognize our worry and our anxiety. And there's a difference. Let's be clear about this, too. There's a difference between the anxiety, the worry that Jesus is talking about, and legitimate concern for meeting responsibilities. I mean, I take concern that my kids have things and whatnot, you know, that they're fed, that they're clothed. But when it shades into that toxic worry because I've lost sight of where the real treasure is and where the real goal is.
You know, you're tapping into something there that I think is really, really important because I think that there is – well, two extremes to which people go about that. And one of them is that, you know, they fret and worry like the world. And the other extreme is I'm not supposed to have a care at all for earthly things. And I think both of those are unreasonable positions.
Extremes.
Yes, because you know, certainly, if the storm is coming, I'm going to see to it that my family is protected and safe. Is that worry?
No, that's just prudent concern.
Or is that responsibility?
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So I think that a couple of things constitutes the worry that Jesus has here. One of them is a distracting concern where I get so consumed of I've got to protect the world stuff now that I don't take care of the stuff that relates to the hereafter.
Right.
And the other is just being burdened by it so that I'm robbed of joy and happiness now. And I wonder, too, how much that's connected to probably the more difficult segment of this in 22 and 23 where he talks about, you know, the eye and whether you live in the light or live in the darkness.
Yeah.
And
how you perceive things.
Well, yes, and whether or not I have that clear vision of what the ultimate goal is. Like you were talking about it a minute ago. We're destined to be with our Father in heaven, and we're living amongst a bunch of stuff that is destined to be the ruins.
Right.
And so I'm not really worried about the ruins because I'm headed to be in my Father's house. And so I think the more clearly we see that, the easier it is to cope with the stuff that is around us. But the more we're corrupted and we don't see that,
right,
and consumed with the stuff around us, then the more our life is out of focus and we get into the mess.
Right. Right. And I think especially on putting this section, as Jesus does, right on the heels of these other spiritual practices, which are all about, you know, either, you know, giving away, giving to God, focusing upon God, praying to God. All of these things reflect a loosening of our hold on this life and the hold on this world. You know, and then the second half of this chapter represents a grasping harder on the stuff of this life and this world, which is the antithesis of that. And part of it comes back to is I think it's just, you know, we're anxious and we worry sometimes, not just because of a fear of loss, but because we want control as opposed to releasing and allowing ourselves to be dependent upon God. And so even just at the end of the chapter, verse 34, therefore his summary statement, don't be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious about itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. Don't worry about that which is not even yours to have or to give or in your control.
Yeah, there is that illusion.
Yeah.
Of control. See, I think people that live on the Gulf Coast ought to never have that illusion.
Not in the hurricane season.
anyone who's been through a hurricane or a tornado just knows.
That's exactly right.
This illusion that you're in control of things, or for that matter, you know, more recently in the news, the wildfires out in California. You know, here are people who wake up one morning and they're forced to flee as a fire just comes down and consumes every last thing they have. I've watched some of the interviews with people going literally back through the ruins and everything they owned in their house is ashes. And it all happened in a moment. And so how are we not taught by that? The idea that I control this is an illusion. And it seems to me that's what he's saying in 19 and 20.
Absolutely.
You know, this stuff isn't going to last. Don't let that be the thing that consumes you. And by the way, what great lessons to be instilling in your children this week as we especially think about how we take this stuff and make it relevant to our kids.
Yeah.
What a great exercise to go through with them, to work this text, and to remind them that what's really important in your life is not your stuff, but your relationship with God. And I really do think as parents, sometimes we are sending the opposite signal.
If we're not careful, that's certainly possible.
The schoolwork is more important than the Bible class work. Being at the ball game is more important than being at worship on Sunday night. And all of that helps to support this idea that the worldly stuff is more important than the spiritual stuff. So that's a great lesson for us to ponder and to take a careful look at as mom and dad as we ponder the message that we're sending to our kids. So Matthew chapter 6 this week. Join us next week. We'll be back with the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 7, as we continue making our way through the Gospel of Matthew.